This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Thank you. All right, so last time we did Muhammad, so please do check out the podcast if you would like to, if you weren't here, because I am going to mention him a little bit, not too much, but he's, of course, a very central figure, even in Sufism. Let's talk about it. God, love, humanity, and Islamic mysticism. A huge scholar, Anne-Marie Schimmel. If you'd like to check out her book, that's basically the source material. And I think the book on Islam that was recommended, she's also the author of that too. So, all right. So it's mystical, right? It's supposed to be mysterious. That's the idea, right? Intellectual effort is anathema, right, to mysticism. That's not to say that Sufis did not pursue, right, academic disciplines. Most of the people that we're going to talk about, they're very well versed in theology and Islamic jurisprudence and everything. However, there are just as many who actually shun any kind of intellectual endeavor. Beware the false prophets, right? so there are many Sufi leaders throughout history that have tried to, from certain perspective, mislead people. And we'll talk about that a little bit as well. Divine love, what separates mysticism from asceticism, right? So we'll talk about what forms of divine love, I guess. A big notion in Sufism is that it's not really tied to any religion. It has always existed. So the first Sufi is supposed to be Adam, right? So going all the way back, he possessed nothing, right? He was only for the love of God. He existed only for the love of God until Eve came, I guess. Got bored with love of God, I guess, for a little bit. Anyway, Anne-Marie Schimmel, Professor Schimmel, she breaks it down into a couple of different categories, voluntaristic mystic, which is, I guess, the more common. So you start qualifying, right? You're supposed to annihilate yourself. You're supposed to take on the qualities of God, so you become one with God. The Gnostic mystic is always striving for deeper knowledge and is in a state of bewilderment, right? So both are equally important, both approaches, neither is wrong. But the Gnostic mystic throughout history has not really attracted many followers, right? Because followers need answers, right? Tell me, guide me, tell me the way, right? So the leader, the teacher, the saint, I guess, who can affirmatively say, I know the way, right, is definitely going to attract a lot more followers. But the mystic who acknowledges, I don't know, right, is probably not going to attract as many followers. But both approaches are fairly strong. But we have more examples of the voluntaristic mystic throughout history. Tasawwuf is the Arabic term for Sufism, really. Big concepts, Wahdat al-Wujud, so the unity of being, right? Becoming one with God. That's the one of the underlying concepts. Another huge concept that's often mentioned is annihilation, fana, right? Fana, the annihilation of ego, of the self, for the love of God. And the biggest theme that represents that is in Persian poetry, and Urdu poetry, Hindi poetry, as a moth to a flame. And so why does the moth get attracted to it? I mean, flame represents, right, God. Right? Flame is the beauty, the light of God. The moth knows it's going to perish, but still it's attracted to it, and only in that annihilation will it know the mystery of God, right? Like actually having experienced that mystery. So that's the general idea. From a very early stage, Sufism did get linked to challenging of dogmatism and legalism. So Attar, one of the poets we're going to read is Hafez, and his teacher, Attar, says, Abu Hanifa has not taught love, Shafi has no traditions about it, and these are two of the, so there are four Sunni schools of jurisprudence, legal thought, and these are two of them, and there are Shia, a couple of Shia schools as well. But so we can see that legalism is, even though these people are very learned and they have learned all these, but they still challenge, right, the dogmatism as well. Something interesting, it's been settled, I guess, the debate, but scholars often, where does the term really originate? How did it come to be? And there were lots of different theories. Most widely accepted is Jama'i Suf, so those who wore woolen garments, right? So Sufis, a lot of them were ascetics, wandering Sufis, and wore the woolen garments. So that's the most widely accepted. Others that have been put forward, Safi Abul in the first rank. So it could be either in the first rank of the prayer after Muhammad in Medina. It could also be just in the first rank as far as God is concerned, as far as spirituality is concerned. Ashabi Safa, people of the bench. So these are the poor people, actually, who in Medina. So right, we talked about last time how Muhammad migrated from Mecca to Medina to set up a community. The Muslim community started in Medina. And so there were a lot of poor people who'd come with him, and they didn't have any place to live. So they would just stay at the mosque. Right? So they would always gather around him, people of the bench. And Muhammad's house was attached to the mosque. Right? So these are people who gathered around the Prophet, Ashabi Safa. And then just Safa by itself is purity. So it can be, and we see all of this, right? It's part of the Sufi memory, understanding of their role in history. Relationship between man and God, of course, just like any other creature and creator, slave and lord. But as far as poetry is concerned, the union is concerned with the one being, the lover and beloved, is the most common theme in poetry. And this is where a lot of Sufis, many Sufis, will get in trouble with the authorities. Right? This way of talking about unity with God, because Islam, right, very much in the Jewish tradition, cannot have anything associated with God, right? So, well, if you are joining with God, how can that be? Like, God is his own entity. Junayd al-Baghdadi, so just some definitions so we can kind of conceptualize it, how different Sufis have tried to define. What do they say about definition? Like, to define is to limit, right? An idea. So it's a hard concept to define, of course. So many definitions, right? Junayd al-Baghdadi, father of the Baghdad Sufism. There's a Baghdad school, the Basri school, both Iraq, Baghdad central Iraq, Basra southern Iraq. Junayd al-Baghdadi is a huge, huge name. Sufism is not achieved by much praying and fasting, but it is the security of the heart and the generosity of the soul. A little bit convoluted, and that's how it's supposed to be, really, right? Ruwaym, a contemporary of Junayd, Sufism is to sacrifice one's soul. So very simple, straightforward. As it's stated, not, of course, the idea, right? The sacrifice of one's soul. Kharakani, a true Sufi, is he who is not. A true Sufi is he who is not. I just love that one. So this, I mean, it kind of makes that, tickles the brain, right? And makes us think about the concept of annihilation, really, right? So you stop being. Stop being. Rumi, what is Sufism? He's asked, what is Sufism? To find joy in the heart when grief comes. Other contemporaries of Junaid, the first one, Junaid al-Baghdadi, the Sufism is to possess nothing and to be possessed by nothing. So this is the kind of alluding to Adam as well, right? The first Sufi, as Sufis would say, before Eve, that is, right? So Adam before Eve, and following that kind of line. He that is purified by love is pure, Safi. He who is purified by the beloved is a Sufi. So lots of different definitions. Pretty much the opposite of orthodoxy, right? So Sufism versus orthodoxy, contemplation over action, spiritual development over legalism, cultivation of soul over social interaction, which is another problematic idea as far as orthodoxy is concerned. Islam, very much religion of the world. It's not a religion of the renunciant, right? So you're supposed to take part in the world. This whole idea of proselytizing, right? Going and converting others. I mean, as an ascetic, if you're only focused on the internal soul, you can't really do that, right? So the idea is a very much based on social interaction. And another thing that we talked about last time, Muhammad, so many decisions that he made were to start a community. So the Muslim Ummah, if you've heard the term, so a lot of his decisions, the very key strategic decisions that he makes, a lot of them that we maybe don't agree with now, if we judge him by our 21st century standards or something, right? But it's very much based in the community. So social interaction, how can you have community without social interaction, right? So, and of course, emotion over reason. I just wanted to put this up there. A quick question. What does this resemble from our own life experiences? What do you think?
It's more like those contemplative monks.
Okay. So interesting story on this is khirqa, and this is what Sufis would get after. So they would master, they would learn with the teacher, and they would, once they have mastered, generally it was a text. Each teacher was a master in a certain philosophy, a certain text, and he would teach, he or she, there were female saints as well. So they would teach their students those texts, and once the student has mastered, then the student can go and start their own little chain of Sufi brotherhood. So this is the khirqa, the graduation gown. So kind of resembles, right, our graduation gowns with the big sleeves and everything. So the story actually goes that this is probably where the whole idea of a graduation gown comes from. Take it or leave it, kind of thing. But, all right. Orthodox response, as I mentioned earlier, shirk, association of someone or something with God, highly problematic in Islam. So this that whole concept of wahdat al-wujud, the unity of being, that you annihilate and you become one with God, you take on the qualities of God, how can that be? Right? This is absolutely not possible. How dare you? Right? Of course, the corrupting influence on the youth. There's a longer story with that, I mean, generally speaking, the biggest ones would be that you have, I mean, if the people are telling you, like, social interaction is not necessary, legalism is not necessary, a lot of Sufis are saying that. But the other, there's another thing that starts happening. So very early on, after Muhammad's death, so Muhammad dies in 632, and very soon thereafter, the first year, the first caliph is putting down some rebellions. There's a wars of apostasy. A lot of people say, well, we had a contract with Muhammad. That's why we converted. Muhammad is dead. That's it. We're leaving. So so the first caliph does that, but the second caliph is the one that this starts this whole idea of jihad to conquer, not necessarily for conversion, but to bring more territory in the fold of Islam so that it will be ruled in the way that God has wanted. Anyway, I kind of digress. I'm sorry. So the corrupting into, so the idea is, like, when they conquered Persia, Persia is a high culture, right? Persian culture was a lot more sophisticated than the Bedouin Arab culture of the desert. So Persian poetry, Persian culture kind of seeps into the Sufi tradition, Islamic tradition in general, but and a lot of it is very homoerotic. So pederasty, part of it, right? So that becomes part of Sufi poetry as well. And I mean, if you think of, like, the old Greek and Persian, like, kind of culture, I mean, that's all part of it. So Sufis start talking about a very weak hadith. Most scholars, Islamic scholars, would reject it, but one of the hadiths that Sufis kind of take and run with to compose that poetry or to justify that poetry is that Muhammad says, I saw the beloved in the form of a young boy with his cap ari. So the boy, the young tavern boy with a crooked hat becomes a symbol of the beloved. So kind of like a stand-in for God sometimes. So, I mean, you can see God in any form, right? Like, who's to say you can't see God in which form, right? But as far as orthodoxy is concerned, there's definitely some issue with that. Right, so a big no-no. I can't have that. Sorry, which is, of course, so all of this is, of course, disruptive to social order, because so the there are sober mystics, Sufis, that very much say no. The way is to follow Muhammad. So Muhammad, we also talked about last time. He used to go meditate for days on end in a cave, right? So it's not just praying in a mosque and fasting, but he's inwardly focused also. So there's social interaction, there's that community part, but he is very much a spiritual seeker looking inwards as well. The fact that some of them are saying, no, this ecstasy is how you get to it, because who knows what's the way to finding the mystery, right? A lot of them say it can't be reached by, you cannot attain that knowledge through normal means, right? So normal studying, fasting, praying, all of that stuff. So wine, right? Wine sessions, that binge drinking, that gets you in a certain state, right? Those become part of the poetry and very much part of the tradition. So that's also a big no-no, right? For the orthodoxy in Islam, right? Alcohol is forbidden. Over time, as I mentioned earlier, beware of the false prophets, because of certain brand of Sufism, which shuns intellectualism and just says, no, you don't need to get bogged down with that. And I'll get to actually that they actually try to justify that using Muhammad's own example. We'll get to that in a second. But A lot of them take advantage of that, and even now, it's a problem even to this day. Countries like Pakistan or Bangladesh, the Sufi orders are administered or they have oversight. The government has oversight over them, really, right? That's the idea. So how do people vote? Right? Well, whoever the descendant of the saint whose shrine it is, well, whoever that person says you vote for, that's who you vote for. Like, this is the first. So this has become very political, definitely, in so many ways. Other places like Turkey, of course, the Sufism was outlawed after World War I, with the establishment of the Turkish Republic. Yeah, they wanted to just break away from Islam altogether. And even as early as late 1500s, Mughal Emperor Akbar's courtier composes this poetry. The Sufi is busy, so the Sufi is not the hero in this poem. The Sufi is busy with deceiving men and women. The ignorant one is busy with building up his body. The wise man is busy with the coquetry of words. The lover is busy with annihilating himself. So the lover is a true Sufi. Sufi is not the true Sufi. The lover is a true Sufi. So, presently, in a lot of places, the word Sufi has taken on kind of a pejorative meaning. And because of all the shenanigans of Sufi mystic saints. I mean, if you can imagine, right, all the scandals that we have with gurus at ashrams and everything, like sexual deviance and all that stuff. So in some cases, rightly deserved, right? And Muhammad Iqbal, he is one of the very well-known Islamic philosophers and poet. He warned of Peterism, absolute sway of the leader teacher and the exploitation of peasants and villagers in India, which we still see to this day. In India, it still happens, even though in India, it's Sufi shrines will not be linked to the government, but it's a secular country. But still, I mean, there are Sufi shrines that, or the people associated with Sufi shrines that do still take a very active role in politics. Let's move to certain examples of Sufis. I should probably put saints in quotations, perhaps. Sufis, saints, and poets. A couple of poets I'm going to talk about at the end. Definitely not Sufi masters in any sense, but very much exemplars of really Sufi poetic tradition in the subcontinent. So we'll get to that Indian subcontinent. Muhammad. So apart from Adam, Muhammad definitely is the exemplar of what a true Sufi would be. So, and this is where that whole idea of anti-intellectualism comes, right? So Muhammad, a big claim for Muhammad was that he was illiterate. Why? Because he had to be the perfect vessel for God's word, right? So the Quran, which is considered the uncreated word of God, like, right? It's always existed, just like God, so it wasn't created. So, and eternal, and co-eternal with God. So uncreated and co-eternal are the terms that are used for the Quran. That he had to be that way so that he's not polluted and corrupted by the normal intellectualism and everything. So the example of Muhammad is definitely used when we talk about that. The other reason why Muhammad is important is, so Muhammad dies in 632. There are people that want, they're called Shia Talali. So, you know, there's a Sunni split and a Shia split. And Shia Talali, literally the party of Ali, they want the caliphate to be to stay in Muhammad's family. There are others who say, no, it has to be a consensus amongst everybody, and let's see who we choose. And so they elect three people before Ali gets his turn. And but it's said that, so not the other caliphs, Ali was the one who had been given the mysteries that Muhammad had, right? That he'd gotten through all the revelations because God gave him, right? His word, really. And that's the only way to know God, through his word. So another story that goes along with that. So Muhammad, this is in Mecca, so before 622, before the migration to Medina. So Muhammad is, so it's like a miracle story. Muhammad is transported to Jerusalem, and from there he ascends to the heavens on this mystical beast, like a flying horse kind of thing, Barakah. And when he goes and meets with God, God says, Muhammad, all this creation is for you, right? Like, I created all of this for you. So you are the cause and the goal of creation. So this is very much also seeped in Sufi tradition. Al-Hallaj, a famous Sufi, we're going to talk about him in a little bit. As reported to have said, God has not created anything he loves more than he loves Muhammad and his family. So the Sufi tradition, the chain, there has to be some link. So even the present day Sufi tariqas or brotherhoods, they have to show some kind of link. Silsila is the word that's used, literally chain or link, translated as chain or link, and so they have to tie it back to Ali somehow. So it has to be tied to Muhammad's family in one way or another. Hasan al-Basri, patriarch of Basra, right, southern Iraq. Different schools of thought. Baghdad is going to be definitely a big player. Basra is another big player. Southern Iraq, mostly Shia. Baghdad also, but more of a concentration in Basra. So there's that difference as well. So Hasan al-Basri, right, he is one of the early and often considered as one of the patriarchs of Muslim mysticism. So once again, right, the second caliph, 634, 35, there's a meteoric kind of rise of the Islamic Empire, the Muslim Empire, conquests all over. By the time we come to 661, actually, Ali is assassinated, and the Umayyad dynasty, the first Islamic dynasty, takes power. And, of course, they continue the conquest. So al-Basri is witnessing this. Of course, he's like, oh, yeah, great, Muslims are having all this victory, but he also sees that they're becoming all about conquest. Like, what's going on, right? Like, this isn't what faith is supposed to be. So I mean, that's his, of course, take on it. And Umayyad dynasty, right, very much disliked. They're the people who actually killed perhaps Ali. Not necessarily for certain, but definitely they kill Ali's children, who are Muhammad's grandsons. So, I mean, very interesting, right? To be killing Muhammad's grandsons and then claiming the caliphate to become leaders of the Muslim community, right? That's so the height of corruption. you think we've got it bad? No, maybe not. Maybe I shouldn't touch that. Anyway, So, where was I? So Basri, right? He's one of the sober mystics. He's not into that ecstasy and that type of approach. He's considered one of the sober mystics, and he is always tells people live according to the rules of the Quran, right? In different interpretations, though, right? Quran, you can justify scripture to do anything. So Sufis often, even if they say follow the Quran, they will look for hidden meanings. So numerology is a big part. I think biblical studies have been done on that, too. I know in Jewish tradition it's a big thing, numerology. So same thing in Islam, finding the hidden meaning in the Quran. So live according to the rules of the Quran. The first saint in the Sufi tradition. So Basri, Sufi master for sure, not really considered a Sufi saint by everybody, but Rabia definitely, she is considered a Sufi saint, and people say she's actually the first Sufi saint. We don't have a lot of women after that, unfortunately, but there is that, the example of that in the tradition. So Rabia Dawiya, Rabia Basra, once again, it's from Basra, so the importance of that city, right, in the Sufi tradition. She is orphaned at a very young age, sold into slavery, but does her duties every day, but then at night, late into the night, she's prostrating and is praying to God and just asking God that just like accept me, right? And forgive me and like, accept me to heaven, all that stuff. One day the story goes that her master wakes up in the night, goes and sees Rabia praying like that, and he sees a lantern kind of floating above her to illuminate her, and he realizes that, oh my gosh, she's not a normal human being, she's a saint, and I free you, but I want to serve you. And she's like, no, just free me, and I want to go out into the desert and just do my asceticism. So whereas Al-Basri, Hasan al-Basri, was an example of a sober mystic, she is the example of very much an ascetic mystic. So she's out in the desert, does attract followers, many, many followers, but always remains secluded for the most part. I mean, she teaches, but she wants to be left alone. Another thing that's often talked about is that, oh, because she stayed by herself, she never married in Islam, right? The idea is like, no, you are supposed to, both men and women, you're supposed to get married, you're supposed to have children, you're supposed to build the community. And of course, she went the other way. So she's an example for a lot of women as well, if they want to use that, as much as patriarchy would allow them to cite examples. this quote is attributed to Rabia, that one day she is seen in town running with a bucket of water and a torch, so she's got like fire and water in her hand, and they're like, what are you doing? What are you doing, Rabia? And she's like, I'll just read it because I'm going to mess it up. I want to put out the fires of hell and burn down the rewards of paradise. They block the way to Allah. I do not want to worship from fear of punishment or for the promise of reward, but simply for the love of Allah. And it's also said that she actually, when she prays to Allah, she says the same thing, if you believe that I love you for yourself and not because of fear of hell or reward, only then accept me, you know, into heaven. And Rabia is an example of that. Ooh, I better hurry up. We're running out of time. Mansur al-Hallaj, mentioned him a little bit earlier, very famous saying, I am the truth, Anul Haq. Like, he's asked, what is love? Doesn't say, baby, don't hurt me. He says, you will see today, tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow. So one of the stories, and there are different accounts, so one of the stories says that his hands and feet are cut that day, the next day hung on the gallows, the third day his ashes are spread into the wind, and that is love, the love of the beloved, right? That he's giving everything that he has for the love of the beloved. He's also known as having said often in the streets of Baghdad, kill me, O my trustworthy friends, for in my being killed is my life. I want to tell so many more stories of him, but I'm going to continue forward. Maybe one thing is so important in Halaj. So when he's in prison, he's like in prison for like 7 years, and he writes huge, long poems, odes to Muhammad, like these hymns, and praising Muhammad. But he also writes other kind of philosophical works. And one is a dialogue between God and Satan. And Satan, so he says, well, he's got a dilemma, right? People are saying that, how can you be one with God? You're saying, Anul Haq, I am the truth, I've become one with God. And he's trying to portray that Satan had the same kind of, not the same, but he had a very big dilemma as well, that should he follow God's eternal command that you do not bow or you do not worship anybody else but him? And then he's telling me, this, giving me this command right now, bow in front of Adam. So how do I, like, which one do I follow? So actually also where people hate, like the orthodoxy would hate him, because he would say Satan was probably the most monotheistic being ever, because he's like, no, I am not bowing against anybody or in front of anybody, only you, God. Don't ask me. I'll even defy you if you tell me to bow in front of somebody else. So that's how monotheistic he is. So it's just, oh, I get goosebumps thinking about that story. I don't know if you're getting into or not. Jalaluddin Rumi, considered one of the huge, huge Sufi masters, born in Balkh, Afghanistan, moves to Anatolia, Rum. Rumi and God, love, and religion. Silence is the language of God. All else is poor translation. I searched for God and found only myself. I searched for myself and found only God. And this is huge in Sufi literature. There's a short book called Conference, the story called Conference of the Birds. And all these different birds are flying, and more and more birds are joining, and they're trying to find the leader. They're trying to find the leader and to whom to follow. And in the end, what they discover is that they didn't have to go anywhere. Always, like, the presence of God or the one eternal truth was always within them. They didn't have to follow any, find a leader or a teacher or anything. It was always within them. In every religion, there is love, yet love has no religion. One of the poems in your handouts, I've given you if you want to read it. So Rumi and Hafiz, I used these translations by Coleman Barks and David Ladinsky. And Barks isn't as problematic. Barks' Rumi isn't as problematic as Ladinsky's Hafez. Neither one spoke Persian, so there's a lot of there's some criticism, a lot sometimes, that they're not really translating, they're interpreting, and they're working from other translations. So as it is, when you translate once, you've lost some of the meaning, but then if you interpret further from a translation, so people have said, like, you're just rendering like originals now, it's not even. So, but the only reason why I included a couple of their works was because this is the most commonly, I guess, available Hafiz and Rumi and Hafiz work that is available in the West. And very much done for consumption of the New Age kind of thinking. Not Christian, or this one could be actually, but just because the format in couplet form, if you look in your handout, So not Christian or Jew or Muslim, not Hindu, Buddhist, Sufi or Zen, not any religion or cultural system. I'm not from the East or of the West, not out of the ocean or up from the ground, nor natural or ethereal, not composed of elements at all. I do not exist. I am not an entity of this world or the next, did not descend from Adam or Eve or any origin story. My place is placeless, a trace of traceless, neither body or soul. I belong to the beloved, have seen the two worlds as one, and that one call to and know first, last, outer, inner, only that breath-breathing human being. I know I'm kind of rushing through it. I'm short on time. Started really late. There's a way between voice and presence where information flows. In disciplined silence, it opens. With wandering talk, it closes. Another huge name after Rumi. Rumi was from born in Afghanistan. His family flees the Mongol invasions and goes into Anatolia. And kind of an, not aristocratic, but his father was a spiritual teacher in his own right. So Rumi actually grew up in a household that was very much seeped in knowledge and learning. Shamsuddin, poor family. He works in the daytime, goes to school at night, but he's also very learned in Islamic philosophy, jurisprudence, and everything. I'll let you read that later, I guess. Really cool poem. And so this is where we can see some of the problems coming. One thing, of course, I mean, stylistic poetry, ghazals or any other poetries didn't have titles. This is very much for the English reader to have, or Western reader really, to have titles for poems. Also, nobody's going to be at that time wasting paper writing like this. So it's very much stylized. But when you change the formatting of a poem, right, it changes the meaning, where the stops are, right? And so what do you emphasize, what do you don't? So these are the things, and they would be okay if both these people, if they give you the original along with it, transliterated, and then stylized. Oh, put down. Oh, I'm so sorry. Couldn't.
Can we got it, like 2 or 3 more minutes?
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. All right. Mir Taqi Mir, Lucknow, India. So, let me see. So these are my translations, so I can definitely vouch for them. They're fine. So this is ghazal, no title, in couplet form. Dekh to dil ke jahan se uthta hai, ye dhuaan sa kahan se uthta hai. Look, does it rise from the heart or the soul? And it can be other meanings as well. From where does a smoke-like thing rise? Gor kis dil jale ki hai ye falak, Shola ek subhak yahan se uthta hai. Which scorned or burnt one's grave is this? O heaven, an ember rises every morning from here. Baithne kaun de hai phir usko jo tere aasna se uthta hai. Whoever shall let him sit again, or come in again, he who gets up or leaves from your shrine. Ishq mir ek bhari patthar hai, love o mir is a heavy burden. Literally, it's a rock. So this is where the translation, right? I took the liberty, but I'm showing you where I'm taking the liberty. Kab ye tujh na talaan se uthta hai? How could a weak one like you bear it? So since I only have a couple of minutes, I would look. So all this poetry was oral tradition, Arabic, Persian, Urdu. These are very much oral tradition. Yes, they were written down, but they were supposed to be recited with lyricality. Anyway, I think we are out of time. Thank you so much for coming.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.